Hello and welcome to In Her Corner, a podcast dedicated to celebrating and empowering women working at every level of sport on and off the field. I'm your host, Liseli Sitali, and today I've got a guest who's actually giving me a little bit of anxiety, but also equal excitement because of her day-to-day job, and I'll introduce her shortly so you'll find out why. It's the absolutely brilliant Charlie Copsey, who is the founder and owner of Copsey Productions and the Underground Fan Club, and is, of course, an award-winning producer, hence my nerves. Welcome to the show, Charlie.
Oh my God, Liseli, you do not need to be worrying. Honestly, you've done such a great job, and I've listened to this podcast since the very beginning when you brought it out, and and I love it. So I think you're doing a great job, and I'm not going to do any critiquing. And it's really weird, I promise. And it's really weird for me to be the other side of the microphone. So it's kind of I'm slightly just as nervous as you are. So we're in this together.
Brilliant. That has eased my nerves. So thank you for your kind words. And of course, as I mentioned there, you head up two great companies and companies that really sit at a great intersection of sport with the entertainment element and bringing fans a lot closer to the action of their heroes and the sports and the communities they love. So do you want to talk a little bit about how you got to this? Because you've had such an extraordinary journey to here.
Yeah, it's certainly, I would say, a different journey from most people's. And that's, again, something that I really love hearing on this podcast, because I think all the women that you've had on have had such different journeys. And I think it's really important for people to understand that there isn't just one route that, you know, kind of that everyone takes. Everyone has a very different route, and it's really good to highlight that. So I went to Loughborough Uni, and everyone goes, "Oh wow, you did sport." And I actually didn't do sport. I did drama. And to be honest, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I just loved doing drama, and it was 6 hours a week, and I was like, yeah, this is going to be breezy. So I went, but I had an amazing time, and I think that was the time in my life where I was almost kind of found myself, and I realized that I was a really good organizer. So I was the social sec on our in our halls at Loughborough. So that meant I just organized all the parties, and I don't think I ever paid to get into any club or like to paid for a drink for about 2 years.
That is big major kudos. Especially at a university like Loughborough. So for everybody who's listening internationally, everyone who's listening internationally, Loughborough is based here in the UK, and the university that is famous for having produced some of the world's most successful athletes and Olympians to date. And it's a school that is typically recruits people who are at the top of their sports game, or indeed, as we're about to find out, entertainment.
The drama game?
Yeah, the entertainment. No, entertainment game, right? Because you and a few others have met recently, went to Loughborough, and you've all gone on to do really well in the world of entertainment. So
yeah, there are a lot of incredible alumni that went to, like, you end up when you're doing this job, it's like amazing how many people you meet, and you're like, oh my God, another person that went to Loughborough. So I had an amazing 3 years, but had no idea what I wanted to do at the end of it, and I just knew that I wanted to move to London. So I had a friend that was working at a production company, and I think I was applying for internships at events companies, because that was kind of a route that I thought I wanted to go in. And but I mean, you know, these were 6 months unpaid, and back then you're just thinking, yeah, I'll do anything. Even though I'm thinking, how on earth am I going to pay for all this? And luckily a friend was working at a production company, and they were looking for a runner, and it just happened to be one of those serendipitous moments where I'd ended up getting a flat with a friend, and it was a thing of like, do I get a flat first and find the job, or do I try and find the job and then figure out where to live? And I got a flat, and the week before I moved in, actually, I started at this company, and I think I just went down and had a cup of tea, and it wasn't even an interview. They were just like, yeah, great, can you start next week? So that was me working at this company. It was a really small production company. They did loads of different things. And one of the shows that they produced is a show called Fighting Talk, which is a sports and entertainment show on BBC Five Live. And it's actually a show that I still work on. So I don't know, 14 years later, maybe, incredibly still working on this show. Yeah. And I actually was just filling in for someone that was away on holiday for a couple of weeks, and I just got on really well with the team and loved it. And I've stayed ever since. But during that time, I worked on loads of different projects, from documentaries in TV to entertainment shows. I even was assistant producer on a feature film, which was an incredible experience. But I'd kind of got all these skills and was in all these different industries. And then I'm kind of at this point where I'm like, okay, what am I doing with my life? And it almost came to a point, I'm sure a lot of people have had this. So it's like, okay, I need to think of what the next steps are. And I was in all these different industries, you know, like had this amazing experience in the film industry, and I'd got all this experience in the sport industry with Fight and Talk and all these other projects I've done. But, you know, it's not something that you can carry on doing, and you can't, you know, kind of flip between, you know, four different industries. So, I just made the decision that I just needed to kind of do my own thing, really. So I had no plan, actually. And I decided to set up my own production company, but there was certainly no business plan. There was no, it's not like I had any clients or anything like that. I ended up leaving the company, but I said I'll still carry on working on Fight and Talk. So I've got a bit of income. And from there, I guess I just kind of figured things out, really. And I worked on, people were very supportive. It was it was incredible. And I had, and that's testament to the network that I've got. And that is something, I'm sure we'll talk about that at some point, and how so important that is for a lot of people. And it certainly is for me. And yeah, I just had incredible support, and just started building up work from there, working in podcasts a lot, working in more radio. And that was the moment, probably about a year after I'd set up my company, where I had the idea for the Underground Fan Club. And that came about really because I'd built up all these amazing relationships with talent that comes on Fighting Talk. So from comedians to sports people. And we've always been a show that's brought on talent kind of probably ahead of everybody else. So
you found the next big thing, right? Everyone tuned in to Fighting Talk to know who the next big sort of stand-up comedian was going to be, who was going to be running the world circuits or, you know, a sport. And that show is kind of like, let's say, the discovery ground. You kind of, it's almost like a little bit of a tip-off, like this person is going to be big because they're going to be on Fighting Talk. So how was it working in that environment when you first came into it? Because as you said, you kind of accidentally fell into it, and you and we've talked a lot in the sense that you weren't superbly fanatic about sport, despite the fact that you ironically went to a university that's world renowned for it. But how did you find adjusting to that world? Did you find it some kind of easy, or did you just take it in your stride? What were the sort of things?
I think it's always a bit of a weird one for me, because Fighting Talk, it's such a popular show. I mean, the amount of meetings I still have with people, and they go, oh my God, I just happened to mention it. And they go, oh my God, I listened to Fighter Talk, or I listened to it with my son, or, you know, everyone has their stories. It's been on the air for 18 years. It's a big flagship show, one of the flagship shows for Five Live. But because I wasn't a sports fan, I always felt a bit like, okay, well, I don't have all this sports knowledge. So actually, do I really have a role in this show? And it was only years later that I realized that I'm the one that has the relationships with the talent, and I've got the eye for finding who are the next, you know, big people, or and also it's a real there's a bit of an art to the panel and you know, the personalities. And I think people just think, oh, you just put on a random four people.
No,
that's absolutely not what happens at all. And you know, when a guest pulls out on a Friday afternoon, it's not the fact that I have to pick and like get another guest. It's like, oh my God, you've just kind of like ruined the whole compatibility of the show.
Chemistry.
So there's kind of quite a lot into it, and you start building relationships with the agents and with the talent, and that's where you know, that's actually a skill that not many people have. And I think, you know, a few years later, it was like, okay, actually, that's my skill, and that's what I bring. And also, it was, you know, the other three, so the Colin is the presenter, and two of the producers on the show are both male. So it's great to have a female perspective in that as well.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, it's just like kind of changes the dynamic. You know, you can't, well, especially now, it'd be so bad to have four males just working on a show. But even back then, I think, you know, I'm bringing something a bit different to the table and have a different view on things. So that was kind of like my foot in the door to the sports world. And to be honest, I mean, even when we spoke, I said, I was like, I've got something to admit to you.
Yeah.
Like, okay. And I said, I'm not a massive sports fan. And and you said, like, I've actually met quite a few people that's the same case.
Yeah.
And actually, I don't think it matters. As we said, it doesn't matter that I don't know all the blooming FA Cup winners. There's plenty of people that know that, but I've got skills that I can bring to the table that actually not many other people do have. So therefore, that's my USP, and that's going to make me stand out from a lot of other people in the industry. So that's kind of like how I got to where I got to, really.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. And it's such an awesome story of that sort of idea of self-discovery and understanding what your strengths are and your professional traits and what separates you, as you say, what makes you so distinctive from the rest of the field, and that unique selling point, which I think is something that it takes you a while to figure out, right, when you're starting off your career, particularly when you're in an industry where on the surface, it seems as if, you know, to borrow a phrase from you, don't belong, or you feel like you're a little bit of that imposter syndrome and you got to get over that. And what I love about your stories that you understood that whilst you may never be that like super sort of, let's say, sports trivia expert, what you were an expert of was understanding people and bringing them together to showcase the best of themselves and their talent and that appreciation for each other's worlds. And I think that is a real skill. And it's a skill that actually, I think it was interesting. I was listening to an interview recently with Toto Wolff, and they were, who's of course the team principal for Mercedes F1 Racing, the most successful team now in F1 Racing. And they and he was being asked, you know, what is your secret? What do you think makes Mercedes so incredibly successful? And I think something was interesting that I see in you is that he talks about how he manages people. He doesn't manage cars. He doesn't manage engineering. He said first and foremost, his job is that management of people, that relationship building. And I think that speaks to the credit of why, you know, your production company has been so successful together with Underground Fan Club, because you've always been people driven first. And I just want to sort of spend some time to just dig a little bit deeper into why it is that you're anchored by being people driven first. Was there kind of an influence in your upbringing or through indeed you finding yourself to Fighting Talk and now your own companies that has made you that way?
I think I would definitely say my parents. So my mum and dad are complete opposites. So my dad he had a full-time job at a company, but he was also the chairman of our city swimming club for many, many years. So sport has actually always been in my life. So I was a swimmer until I was about 12 years old. He was also a team manager for the GB swimming team, because his friend that he went to school with was coach at the time, and so he had a really good relationship with him. Yeah. Wow. He's now the chairman of the Lincolnshire Tennis Association, and he works with the LTA and all these stuff. And he does this all whilst he's retired now, so this is all voluntary.
I was going to say, now his job. He's now found himself a new job. I love it.
He will never, ever, ever stop. He's just like a dual company. So I guess, and he's like, everybody knows my dad. Like, honestly, it's like we used to go on holiday, and then someone would be like, John Copsey, and we'd be like, oh God, who is this now? So I guess I get that personable nature from my dad.
Yeah.
But then I get my kind of, I guess, my empathy and the way my mum is such a caring person, and she's the yin to my dad's yang, and she kind of levels him. And I'd like to think I'm a kind of a mix of both, really, in that sense. So I guess that's probably answers a slight bit of that question. And then
No, it does. Cause I'm always really interested particularly when I meet people who go on to lead companies and teams in the way you do now, and have worked in particularly in fields where they've had to come in and step into a new domain. I'm always curious to understand, like, what were those driving factors? And the reason why I ask it, as you know, Charlie, a huge passion of both of ours, is that I started this podcast because I was inspired by some volunteering and mentoring I do with girls in schools and universities. And they often ask me, you know, like, what is the right way in which to go and build a career? And what are the sort of things that set you up for success? And I think there's this bit of mystique that happens in the entertainment and sports industry where people think that there's something sitting in the background. And why I like to ask that question is just to show that even the things that you don't necessarily think can have such a big influential factor on you in the moment when they're happening to you actually can go on to serve you really well afterwards. And that's why I wanted to ask you that question, just to dig out a little bit about what were your motivating factors to develop the skill sets that you have, right? Because those are all things that people are quite daunted by, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but when I was a kid and I was growing up, I was so shy. I was not, and really? I think it was, oh God, I was so shy. I would be holding mum and dad's hand all the time. I would be When there was friends around or something, I'd just be, it was my sister that was the really outgoing one. Interesting. And so I think,
What was the turning point?
I think probably university. I think that was, as my parents say, it was like your rebrand. I think that's a great thing though. You can go and almost find out who you are, and it's like this next chapter in your life. So I guess uni was probably that turning point for me. But like, you're always I feel like I've changed in the last 3 years setting up my business. I've probably changed again in the last year since going through this whole pandemic. You're constantly finding out about yourself and learning new things and putting yourself into different situations. So I don't think you certainly don't ever stop figuring out who you are and changing.
Yeah, no, definitely. And in the process, when you're figuring out and you're changing, you're adapting, particularly when you're finding your own business, what have kind of been the core things that you have learned about yourself that maybe were unknown to you? Because I see you as quite a very good introspective person. Has there been anything that has come out in that process? Because there's a lot of people at the moment thinking about setting up their own businesses as a result of, having a lifestyle change or a career change because of the pandemic. So what are the things that, for you, you've learned that have been pleasant surprises to you or otherwise?
I'm a very passionate person. I get so involved and so passionate about something to like, oh my God, to the nth degree. But I think you have to have that when you set up a business. And with Underground Fan Club especially, that has been blood, sweat and tears. It's been so hard to do that on my own and to set up a business that's like completely different and trying to disrupt a space that's not really been disrupted before. I don't have a business partner. I don't have anyone helping me with that. I've got a small team of freelancers that work with me and Emma who works with me now. But I'm doing that all on my own. So the hours that you put into this, and there's so many days and weeks that go wrong, or you have rejection, or a million things can go wrong or don't go your way. If you're not passionate about something, then you're going to easily get knocked down and you're probably going to stay down. And I think I'm also, I guess that comes up, but I feel like I'm such a resilient person. If someone says no, I'm like, okay, cool. Well, so how do I get you to say yes? Or I move on and find someone that will say yes. Or there's always a solution. I'm a very optimistic, positive person. Mm-hmm. And I mean, gosh, like you all have your moments where you're just like, ah, God, this is just all going wrong. But I bounce back incredibly quickly.
And do you think that comes from your early days of working in quite a stressful, demanding entertainment environment like you were before, with a lot of men and trying to have to find your voice and fighting to get that cut through? Do you think that's where you got that?
Oh, good question. I don't really know, actually. I think going back to my dad, that is such a trait from my dad. Like, he is just... he is a force of nature and he will get something done and no one will stand in his way. But again, it's like he's very passionate about everything that he does. Yeah. But working in the industry, I don't know whether is it part of your genetic and your DNA? I don't really know. I think some people, you meet some people and they're just a downer on things and they just bring the... I was going to say a Debbie Downer. We all know Debbie Downers, but they just bring energy down and they are just negative about things. And that, I think that's just them. I just think that's their personality and I'm not sure they'll ever change. And that's, I would like to think, and I'm pretty sure I am the complete opposite of that.
I would 100% vouch for that. Yeah, you're the opposite.
There's always a solution to a problem I will be the one to figure it out, whether it's with you or on my own or with someone else. So
No, that's great. And I think one of the things about that as well is it kind of, you become a self-perpetuating prophecy, right? If you kind of give out good energy and you're positive and you will good things to happen. And again, as you say, it has to come from that position of feeling really invested and being passionate in the thing you're trying to achieve. I do believe that it just starts to naturally manifest and attract more of that kind of energy and opportunities. So I think it is something to think about in terms of how people frame their mindset. Oh, I think there's a lot there.
And also going back to that Debbie Downer, it's like no one wants to hang out with these people. No one wants to work with these people. And I think people have to be really aware of this. even if you're having a really rubbish day, if you're about to go into a meeting or if you're about to go on a walk, just put on a positive voice. Be happy, because someone will get off that call and just be like, oh God, that was a bit of a drain. And people think about that, and connections and relationships are just so important. And it's really nice, actually, the amount of calls or Zooms, how many are we on, like in the thousands now, that I have. And everyone's like, oh my God, I've just had such a great half an hour with you. Like, you've really picked me up. And I've no intent, I don't realize I'm doing it, but I guess now it's like, oh, something that I've realized. And it's, it's just nice to do that. And it's something that luckily I don't have to do intentionally. But if someone's listening and thinking, okay, that's not naturally me, well, maybe actually just kind of put a bit of thought into that about how you do come across with other people. And you need to surround yourself with positive people and people that are energetic and are like, because you all feed off each other. So, I'm sure we've heard this a million times, but you know, don't surround yourself with drains, because they will literally just drain you. And that's not good for you or for them, really.
Yeah, no, it's so true. And I think it's also being intentional, right? It's what you're talking about there, is being intentional about the kind of energy you want to bring out and the kind of energy you want to get back. And I think one of the biggest things there, I think that you say there is such a learning in this moment in time. There's been so many down days for everybody, understandably, in the pandemic. And I think sometimes one thing that I kind of have learned, and as I've been going through lots of different job interviews that I've been telling you about in the last few months, has been that actually, often when that person comes on the call on the other side, you can see that they are also looking for a lift. And so for you to go and provide that lift, that bit of energy, that little bit of camaraderie, that moment in the day, as you say, that gets them stepping away going, what a great half hour that was. That can make actually a bigger lasting impression that opens up doors for more opportunities and more work, even if maybe, say, that call doesn't lead to anything. So I think it's also to say to people, be intentional about meeting people with the kind of energy and the kind of memory you want them to keep of you, I think is always what I try to live by.
Oh, definitely. 100%.
And in saying that, though, when you work in entertainment, one of the things people will say, and I'm sure there's a lot of them being like, how about so-and-so that we know that you've worked with on Fighting Talk, who always comes across as a little bit mumpy. How do you manage difficult talent? Because I think that's something that a lot of people who work in sport. Now, I'm curious to ask you, because you've worked with such a great diverse mixture of talent. So how do you manage that? Like, say you put your panel together, and then for whatever reason on the day doesn't go well, or something is not working. How do you manage that difficult situation? Because I think it'll be handy for people to kind of get those tips, because it's a transferable skill, right, to business and boardroom. Yeah.
I guess one thing that I do is treat them as a human being. I don't see them as a celebrity or, you know, wow, they're so famous. I'm just like, okay, you're just like, well, I was going to say just like me, but not. But essentially, it's like, I'm going to treat you I'll treat everybody else, and you need to treat everyone else with a bit of respect as well. So I genuinely, hand on my heart, I don't think I've ever had to work with someone that has been a complete idiot or disrespectful or treated anyone badly. Obviously, that is probably an exception to the rule, because there are many incidents out there that's not the case. But I think it's you know, if a guest pulls out on a Friday and I'm not angry at them. Okay, unless they've pulled out for a really bad reason. And then I'm like, you've annoyed me now. But these things happen. It's just like, your life. Kid's not very well. Okay, well, I'm not going to be angry at you. And there's no point in me being angry at you. And then you're being like, oh God, well, Charlie didn't take that very well. And then like, they're annoyed at me. You know, it's just like, it just doesn't happen like that. It's quite a hard one to answer, but I'm so lucky that I've just worked with incredibly lovely, brilliant people. And hopefully I'll continue to do so, but I do feel I guess that's probably Fighting Talk just attracts a really nice bunch of people as well. You know, we pay everybody exactly the same, and I'm not going to say how much it is, but it's really not that much money. So people are, you know, getting out of bed on a Saturday morning to come to the BBC, or now recording from home, yeah. you know, it's, but to have fun for an hour yeah. or so with yeah. a group of like-minded people. Yeah. So the kind of people that are going to do the show are actually the kind of people that you want to hang yeah. out with yeah. And you want.
Yeah, it's back to that.
Yeah, and if agents say, oh, yeah, but, well, no, they won't do it for that money, I'm like, okay, well, we can't have them on then. Because every single person, whoever you are, gets paid exactly the same. And that's, you know, when I do a project that's favoured nations for talent, I'm like, oh, God, yes, it's so much easier because, like, you don't have to argue about talent fees. And
yeah, yeah. No, it's such an interesting point because, again, what you've done there with the show is that you've created the kind of environment that breeds the cultures and the behaviours that you want it to have,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
The fact that you're treating everybody the same. So everyone comes on with that, not feeling that there's a pegging field or, you know, that there's a kind yeah. of ranking system. Because I think ranking systems can create levels of resentment and that awkwardness that does happen, at least on the sports side, I can say from my experience. I think anytime I've ever seen any friction happen because you've been on a job or a campaign, it's always been because there's this feeling that they're being paid significantly less or more than their
peers.
Oh, God.
And
that creates, exactly. It feeds into those dynamics. And the other thing I wanted to spend some time talking to you about was obviously Fighting Talk is kind of, let's say, the shape and the mode of it. When people hear the title, it seems like quite a sort of masculine environment and very sort of lads about town type of conversation. On the surface is how it presents, but when you actually dig into the show, it's not at all. Do you think having a woman in you and the producing aspect helps to shape that, to stop it away from becoming one of those kind of shows?
I don't think so. I think Colin Murray, who's the presenter, is absolutely not a laddie lad in the slightest. Mm-hmm. And I think he's kind of taken the show in a direction that's certainly not that. And Mike and Simon, who work on the show, again, they're actually not that kind of genre of men, shall we say. So we're always trying to get more women on the show, and that's something that it's not because we have to. Like, we have a quota from the BBC that we actually were given a few years ago, but that's okay, well, cool, but we want to actually exceed that, and we want to do it because of course we want to get female voices on. But the problem is sport is catching up big time with pundits, with journalists, with females in the industry that are high profile talent. And look, at the end of the day, this show is, what you know, a really big show on the network, so we need to have high profile names on it. So you're kind of in this vicious circle of thinking, okay, well, we want to be putting more women on, yet they need to be known, yet they haven't been given the platform to be known, so where does that leave us, you know? It's just this, it's, you know, it's very it's tough, but I definitely say this season we've certainly kind of upped our game in getting more women on as well, which is great, and we'll continue to do so. The amount of, actually, there's so many girlfriends and wives and partners, etc., that I'll say about Fighting Talk, and they'll say, oh, my husband listens to that, or my boyfriend listens. It's the only show that I actually love listening to as well. And I think you don't have to be a massive sports fan to enjoy it and to get the jokes. And I think
it's popular culture. It's very much in the popular culture.
Exactly. Realm. And it's certainly entertainment as well. And, you know, we have kind of like comedians on as well, so they help with that. So as much as it's really proper sporting punditry, you have to know your sport to come on. And if you don't, you'll really get found out. I mean, I don't think we've ever had someone that's kind of bloopered in that. But it's certainly entertaining and comedic as well. So that kind of takes the laddiness off. And of course, there are many, many shows out there that are very laddie and, let's say, you know, banterous or what, I don't know what.
They think they're banter, Charlie.
Yeah,
but they're
exactly.
Not. They're just sexist. But let's call it what it is.
Hate that word banter. Honestly, I'm just like, can we never ever use that? That's just not us.
Yeah, it's of course to cover up a manner of sins, right? That's often when someone uses it, you know,
it's just banter.
Exactly. Yeah. No, so true. That's really refreshing to hear that. And I guess so. By that token, I guess you never faced. Do you feel like you didn't have the same challenges that other women would have stepping into that kind of media environment, because there is a huge skew, particularly here in the UK, in terms of underrepresentation of women in decision-making positions within media and sports, like you've spoken to there, hence the difficulty with finding the right caliber of guests, but also the difficulty as well in those women being given the access to the opportunities. Are you saying that you feel quite lucky that you've been able to circumvent, let's say, that gender gap?
Look, I see a massive gap in gender equality in this industry, as with probably most industries. And there is a lot of catching up to do. I personally, on a personal level, I have never felt that being a woman has held me back. And I just think I've been really lucky, to be honest. And I've been surrounded by an incredible group of predominantly men, actually, that have supported me and let me flourish, I guess. And
And
I think that's probably quite rare. I don't know that many women that could probably say the same. So I think that's always about find your allies, and there's certainly male allies. But I also recognise that I have probably been slightly naive to thinking that I haven't experienced it, but actually I probably have, but I just didn't realize it or even take note of it at the time. We've all, like, there's not one single woman I can't imagine on the planet that has not experienced sexism and has not experienced you walking into a room and a man looking at you in a leering way or whatever, in a work environment, which is just so not acceptable. And even I've been in environments where guys around me, it's almost like you blend in and they end up just saying stuff. And they're just like, oh, it's Charlie. And it's just like, no, I am a woman here. And I'm kind of taking note of what you're saying. And I think over the last couple of years, after the Me Too movement, I think men have certainly been a bit more mindful about what they're saying. Mm-hmm. Personally, I certainly haven't. It hasn't held me back. And to be honest, I think I've probably used it to my advantage in a way.
Yeah.
I think being a woman in a really male environment makes you stand out from everybody else. And I think men and women are very different, and we can't get away from that fact. So how about we use these traits to our advantage? I'm probably more, I was going to say socially aware or maybe empathetic than a lot of men that, I really pick up on people's feelings. I pick up people's body language. Yeah. I can tell if someone's upset or, having a bad day, and I'll say to them, like, are you okay? The amount of conversations that I just have with people that I meet in work, and then all of a sudden I'm talking to them about their relationship and like their girlfriend that they're having an argument with, and then I'm like giving them relationship advice. That's like, a man's not going to do that. So, and then all of a sudden you've kind of built a connection with them.
Yeah.
And you've built, and this is going back to relationships again.
Yeah.
So I would say, and I'm massively generalizing here, of course, but I would say most men would be like, all right, mate. Yeah, you, mate. Yeah, cool. And
end of conversation. Yeah.
Let's talk about football for the next 5 hours.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's that digging deeper and giving people the space to breathe and also be this themselves, right? And that comes, as you say, from developing key skills, I think, that I also make for great leaders, which is empathy, that ability to read people, and that ability to actually truly listen. I think a lot of people, I always say, like, you can often hear people, but how often do you actually listen to them? Right.
Oh,
and
so
that's the real difference. And that's the real difference there. And I think it's such a gift you have. And I've seen you in those moments, and I can totally see it. And also, I think that the genuine care that you have, you can see it. And it's a shame that I don't do a visual podcast, because I haven't learned to video edit. Everyone has to leave me. But if you see, if you get a chance to. No, we're fine. We've capped my skills. We're fine.
Yeah, exactly. No, you've got enough on your plate.
I'm getting old now. The brain is getting tired to learn things. So I'm done. But no, the one thing I have to say to everybody, if you ever get a chance to listen to see Charlie in person, you'll see you've got one of the best expressions that generally brings light and happiness. No, you do. Aww. And I think I have to say that because I think that comes back to what you're saying about being intentional about the energy that you give and how that then draws people in. Because I think that's such a vital learn. It's just a skill that's not taught, but it's a skill that definitely sets you apart to your point that you made there. And I think this leads nicely to us to just talk, because I found this really interesting when you were saying how you've been reflecting about your career and the places it's taken you. And I wanted to just spend some time to talk to you about what made you come up with the concept of the Underground Fan Club and what you've learned in the processes of setting all those kind of things up.
So I came up with the Underground Fan Club because I saw a huge gap in the market for creating experiences and events for fans, predominantly in sport, although we've kind of like moved and ventured off into fitness as well, because that's a real big passion of mine. And I guess this again stems back from Fighting Talk and all the talent that we get on the show. As I said, they love doing the show. They don't get paid much money, but it's just this entertaining kind of hour in their morning where they can come together with like-minded people and just have a good time and talk about something that they're really passionate about. And we ended up doing loads of live shows. We've probably done over 30 live shows, but we were doing live shows before, I guess, podcasts and recorded radio shows were really, you know, a massive thing. So this is what, 11 years ago? And yeah. I remember when we were first asked to do a show in front of an audience, we were all genuinely like, why would someone come and watch a radio show? Like, this is weird. Anyway, so we turns out it's really popular. So
it's very popular.
Yeah. And so we did this show and in Harrogate, I think it was in Harrogate. And we made a weekend of it, went up the night before, had a great meal, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, and it was just so popular. And it was great because it was the first time we really met our fans and we met our audience. Yeah. And they were just like, these people are obsessed with Fighting Talk and have become like this real like
community.
Fan group.
Yeah.
Real community. And we had, I think around that time, they'd set up, I think it was us. We'd set up a Facebook page, but I think it was kind of suggested by these fans. And I think we've got over 14,000 fans in it now. And it was this massive, it was just basically a community. And then we started doing more shows and thousands of people were coming to, and we did one in Hull once, and because it's the BBC, you can't charge for tickets. So, but they allocate a certain amount of tickets, but it means there's more of you, so you won't necessarily get in. And people had like faked tickets and forged these tickets to get in.
Love it.
It is absolute madness. So we did all these amazing shows. Our biggest one was at Liverpool Echo Arena in front of 5,000 people, and we had Primal Scream playing, and
we
did this big day out at Stoke City Football Stadium, and we had about 3,000 there, and we had Ash were playing. And it was amazing. And for me, that was about, wow, we're bringing people together. Mm. And after the show, people would just, the fans would come and chat to the guests and they would stay for ages. And there was none of this, like, we'll sit in the green room business and, you know, not chat to anyone. It was like, just everyone wanted to chat and have photos. Yeah. And it was just amazing. So I guess that sparked something in me thinking, okay, there's something here. And also the talent love doing Fighting Talk and they love doing these shows. And it doesn't seem like anyone's really doing anything in this space. And at the same time, I'm being invited to corporate events and they're just
boring. Call them what they are.
I mean, you literally
I'm inviting you as one of those people who often would sit in rooms where they'd be like, we're launching a new brand. And then they'd be like, let's do this. Let's make this poor talent, well, not poor because they've been paid an astronomical amount of money,
come and be
absolutely bored out of their mind and probably never want to re-sign with us again by making them sit around and have cocktails, that thing that they probably can't drink because they're a high-performance athlete, and talk to a lot of boring middle-level managers. I'm sorry. I can include myself in that group.
Okay,
and why would I just thought I'd say it for you, Charlie, because I thought you were trying not to offend me, but no offense taken. I totally accept this.
I am so glad. You just basically said what I wanted to say.
Yeah, no, because this is how I came across your company, because I was working at that time. I was working at DAZN, and we were looking at launching boxing as a sort of reinventing it and reigniting it. And I was looking at an event you'd done with David Hay, the former world champion at cruiserweight and heavyweight. And I loved it. And I loved the energy that it was putting out. And I just say to people, you know, if we're going to do events, this is how we should do them. They should be about bringing fans that much closer to their hero without all of the sort of corporate stuff that gets in the way and ultimately doesn't allow them to have that unforgettable experience that you described there, that people were coveting to the extent that they were willing to fake tickets for, even though there was no monetary value associated. It's because that experience of that humanness of it in that connection is what they're after. And I think, you know, you have got a very good idea. And then, and I think it's an area that, at least in the corporate side of sport, we need to work a lot harder at being able to translate. Because on the field, we've got a great product, but off the field, how we engage fans needs a lot more hard work.
I mean, it really annoys me, actually, because fans, every sports organization and every club will say our fans are the top priority. You know, we love our fans. And well, do you really? Like, what are you doing for them? Like, you're just basically charging them a ton of money, like through merchandise, through the amount they pay for travel, you know, season tickets, or like traveling abroad, all this stuff. It's like, what are you actually doing to give them these amazing experiences? So it was the fans. So I'm just like, okay, well, they're not getting access to talent. And, you know, I'm very, very lucky. I've got to meet so many incredible sports people and so many celebrities that love sport, et cetera, et cetera. And I get to hear these stories down the pub or, you know, if I did, and I'm just like, but not many people get to hear them. So I really wanted to do something for fans that was really affordable, that was like for anybody. And I wanted it to be about community, but equally important, I wanted it to be something that talent wanted to get involved with. And I wanted it to be something that talent really kind of cared about. Yeah. And we're basically kind of, we're just kind of given another opportunity to connect with fans, because they don't really get that opportunity unless you're doing a meet and greet or I don't really know what else. I think brands these days go, okay, well, we need to put on an event. Let's just get a load of influencers on board and create loads of content. And all fans are sat at home being like, okay, well, I'm not really connected to that, or you know, this isn't for me. And it's just a real, and I have had so many conversations with sports people, especially, who are getting really quite tired of that model. Underground Fan Club, the idea came about, and I mean, you have an idea, but then you have to make it happen. So I have to give a massive shout out to my friend Rich, who I went to uni with at Loughborough. He was actually a sports person and he was a runner. And he has an incredible company actually called Runderwear, which is underwear for runners. And
love it.
It's great. Check it out. But he was just one of those people who was like, Charlie, you just need to do it and I'm going to help you do it. And maybe I would have done it without him, but he certainly gave me a massive push that I needed. And he is just like, right, what do you need? I'm going to support you. And we ended up deciding to do an event for the Joshua Povetkin fight. And because the idea is that you hook it around a big sporting fixture, so then you can, it's almost like a warm up party and you can do a big lead up to it. Because everyone, the week leading up to a Joshua fight is a Joshua fan or a boxing fan. The rest of the year, maybe not so. So it's kind of like getting in on that excitement.
Yeah. No, I'm laughing because definitely not so. I can tell you from trying to sell subscriptions.
Totally. And everyone wants to kind of, everyone gets excited in that week. So it's like, okay, well, let's kind of use that to our advantage. So we came up with the idea. Steve Bunce is a big boxing commentator. I'm sure everyone will know Bunce's voice. He's just so lovely. I remember taking him for coffee and I said, I've got this idea. What do you think? Is it something that you think will work with boxing? And he was just like, oh my God, yes. Like, we're crying out for this kind of thing in this industry. So Bunce was a massive help. And couldn't have really done it without him. He brought down so many people. And then we had Nick Bright hosted it. And I rang up because I knew Nick through Fight and Talk, I think. And I actually rang him. I remember ringing him because I was having a coffee near London Bridge, sat outside one day, and I rang him and I told him about the idea. And I was like, this is what I want to do. Like, I've got no money. I'm paying for it myself. So I'm not going to pay you. And he was like, and I just said, would you host it for me? And he was like, oh my God, yeah, of course I will. And I got off the phone and this guy next to me, who was like in a suit, I think he was Canadian. He like leaned over and he was like, hey, sorry, but so I was just listening to your phone call and this sounds amazing.
Shamelessly eavesdropping. Love him. Yeah, love literally shout out just to like, that guy. Shout out to that guy.
I think I still got his business card somewhere.
Yeah, I was going to say, you must have given an incredible pitch, Charlie.
So, and he just said, oh my God, you sounded like your passion for this is amazing. He was like, I would come to this. He said, honestly, like if we had events like this in Canada, they'd be so popular. And that's when I was like, okay, I think I'm onto something here. Anyway, so Nick hosted it. Darren Harriott, the comedian, I knew he was a boxing fan. So he came on. And actually, I'd actually put Spencer Oliver to come on. And I think it was two nights before on the Monday. His agent, Alex, who's a friend of mine, he messaged me or rang me and he was like, I'm so sorry, but he's now got his commitments have changed for Sky and he can't do it. And the event was on the Wednesday. So this is Monday night. And I was just like, and Buncey also messaged me and said, oh, there's an event going on Wednesday, so I might be a bit late. And I honestly, I was just like, this is awful. What am I doing? Why am I putting myself through all this pressure? Like, this is a disaster. And basically I went to uni with Nicole, who's David Hayes' agent, and she's been with him for like years and years. And I think I was literally thinking about who can I, and you know, David Hayes, I'm like, as if he's not gonna, like if he's gonna turn up for free and do it anyway. I just rang her, or I think I messaged her, and I just said, Nicole, I was just really honest. I was like, Spencer's pulled out. I'm doing this thing. I'm trying it. It's something different. I gave her the sell of like, you know, I want to do something for sports fans. It's really genuine. And she was like, yeah, David's in. He loves it. And honestly, David Hay, like, was my absolute savior. And I'm so thankful. And I always say to Nicole, I speak to her a lot, and I'm like, honestly, you guys, like, properly saved my bacon that night. And so we put on the event and it was great. It was like, and my Fleur East came and DJ'd because she's my friend and she's got no clue about boxing, but she's like, yeah, come down. So so it was great. And it just had such an amazing energy. And it was just so much fun. And, you know, David was like getting people up on the stage and he was showing everyone what Povetkin was going to do and Joshua was going to do. And I dragged loads of mates down who aren't even into their boxing. And even at the end of it, they were like, oh my God, I really want to watch the fight on Saturday now, because they've really, you know, kind of got into
such a great pre-build up. And it's that kind of imagination that I keep saying, you know, is going to be so needed in the sports world now that all going to be, you know, trying to reinvent how we engage with fans and trying to think about different ways, because the venues and the sale of big crowds, that's going to take a while until we can get back to there. So what are the other things that you can do around it that then can create that appetite for the viewing at home, right? Because people are quite fatigued of viewing at home. So what are the things you can now start to think about and do that can actually still create some sort of, let's say, excitement and buzz, as you're talking about, that even gets casual fans to think, oh gosh, that experience was such a rich one. It connected me much closer to that sporting event and moment that then made me start to value the experience of wanting to watch the live event more. And I think, as being a sports marketer who's predominantly worked, you know, in media and broadcast, as you'll know, it's always looking for those hooks that's so important for people and trying to make sure to give them a reason to tune in. And I think, you know, hearing about that and your invention and also your ability, can I just say to people, you know, to try and get people who work in boxing to do anything for free is a trip. I'm just going to call them out. They know who they are.
They know who they are. Buncey did say, honestly, if you just bring down loads of chicken, like a load of boxes will come. Oh my God,
You know what? Steve Bunce is lovely. He's actually always super helpful. I'll give him a shout out from all my days of working with him. But actual boxes, I'm afraid to say he's not correct. Unless those chicken drums are wrapped in lots £100, yeah. they're not coming, Charlie. I'm sorry, I gotta tell you the truth. I don't want to let you down there, but no. And I love about that, why I wanted to call out, the point wasn't just to dig people out, I promise, because people sometimes say that about my podcast. It wasn't that. It was to show that how the value of what you were talking about earlier, your ability to have built those friendships and those relationships through your work at Fighting Talk and other places that you had, are what then allowed you to set up your dream to do something that you were incredibly passionate about and invested in. And people were buying into you. And I think that's such a key learning that you and I talked about when we first sort of connected, about how much nobody teaches you how important that is to develop the level of sort of integrity, respect, and camaraderie that you need to, that sets you up for your success in your career. Because in those moments, as you said, where you were absolutely, you know, sort of at crisis point, let's face it,
it was a dark night.
Yeah. But what allowed you to get out of that was all the years of hard work that you'd put into grafting relationships with people like Nicole, that you could call on to have a really high profile former boxer like David A, who was very much as part of the media hype for a big fight like that because of his connection to both fighters. And I think that is really underestimated as a learning. Are there any other things that you've sort of gleaned from your experiences in being a producer, but also now being a business owner, that like sort of key learnings that you would like to pass on to people like that, that aren't immediately taught and obvious, but really have set you apart? Or if they are obvious, I think it's always good to reiterate them when you see someone successful like you.
I mentioned this at last week's event, which I know that you tuned in for. I strongly, and it's really hard to do this, but don't compare yourself to other people. I think it's really, really important not to do that. Yes, take inspiration. And of course, you know, there's people that I see all the time that I'm really inspired by. And it is so easy to compare, but everybody is on their own journey. And everyone is like, every single person has a different path. And there's so many different factors that really define you and what you're doing. So I would say that's such an important one for me. And look, we all go on social media. I was chatting to Chelsea Grimes about this for this event that we did with the youth group, which is actually about encouraging women to work in sports and entertainment. And we were both saying how social media can really be quite damaging because you're constantly looking at someone's profile. And we've all done it. We've all, especially on LinkedIn, like LinkedIn's the one for me where you look at people and it's all about celebrating. It's all about, we won this pitch. We like, oh my God, this has happened. This has happened. I've had a pay rise. I've had a promotion. No one says, oh, I lost this pitch today. This happened. We've had to make loads of redundancy. You know, it's just, not great, actually, I didn't mean to say that. But it's one thing seeing loads of negativity and that's really going to bring you down. But I think there's having a bit of realism as well. And I'm friends with people, like one friend in particular. He is incredible at his job. He's so well-respected. He is very well known in the industry. Yeah. Everyone from the outside sees his life and he's like, they're like, oh my God, he's absolutely smashing it. Mm-hmm. I know he, because I talked to him about it, he's got insecurities. He thinks that he's, you know, kind of, he struggles with that as well. Every single person is struggling with their own achievements. Everyone has challenges. No one thinks, no one gets to the end of the week and goes, right, I have absolutely smashed it. I'm bloody amazing. Yes, me. And I'm one to certainly, I wouldn't say I celebrate all the amazing things that I do. I'm very critical of myself. And I always go, well, okay, that was, okay, you did that, but why didn't you do this? And okay, you've done X amount of events this month, but why wasn't it five? Or, you know, and it's constantly, I think I have to be less hard on myself about that. But I do. And actually, Emma, who I work with, I met her for last Thursday because we'd had two events in March and we've worked our asses off recently. Yeah. And it's been tough. And I got a bottle of champagne for us. And I was like, let's just take a moment to actually celebrate that we've had a really great month. And, you know, I wanted her to know how much I appreciate her help and her work. And and it's just like you don't, and especially, you know, now we're in lockdown and we don't have those moments where you can just, you know, when we used to do events afterwards, you'd have an adrenaline and you'd have like the everyone would be drinking and
you'd have the buzz of the people. Yeah,
exactly. And we don't do, obviously that's kind of gone. And I think that's something that hopefully will come back. But but not comparing yourself is, I think that people can get down a very bad track, shall we say. It's just not helpful.
Yeah. No, I think that's such a good point. And how when you catch yourself in those moments, as you say, where you're scrolling through something like LinkedIn, which is, of course, you know, it's sadly become a kind of a barometer and a benchmark for all of us in terms of how we're doing. How do you catch yourself out of that chatter when it starts to get negative in your head about that comparator? How do you quieten that voice?
Well, so for social media, I'm really bad on social media. I'm the first, if anyone looks at my accounts, I'll just be like, yeah, you're pretty inactive. And I know how important it is for building my brand and building me as a person. And it's very important, but I have a real issue with every time I post something, I feel like other people are going to think, oh my God, look at what Charlie's achieving. And I'm not good enough, or I haven't done that. And I'm so conscious of that. And I know that some people could say, well, that's their problem. Like, that's their insecurities. But I don't know. Like, I just feel like I don't want to fuel that. And yes, like, I think we all know that social media makes everything look glamorous. And oh, wow, you've like, no one puts up the things that they're failing at or they're struggling with. So to be honest, social media, I don't really look at it. And I don't ever, my friends laugh at me, but because they'll be like, oh, did you see this on my stories? And I say, no, I don't look at stories. Like, I genuinely don't, because I'm like, if it's important, tell me that you did it.
It's that self-protection, right? I think that's something people need to realize. It's self-protection and self-care. And I think that there is a behavior we all need to learn and unlearn in how we associate it and use it. It's such a great medium for connecting. But as you say, there's a lot of things in it as well that can breed a lot of, let's say, negative mindset. And it's so important not to have that, as you say, when you're an entrepreneur and you're going out there and you're trying to do something that is difficult, to try and stop, you know, you wanted to set up success factors, right? And one of those success factors has to be, what is the mental sort of surroundings that you're creating for yourself? So I think it's a good reflection. It's a hard one for people who are like me and addicted. I am addicted. I am the chief scroller, but it's such a good reflection.
But I actually said this to my friend the other day. When was the last time you went on social media and didn't come off feeling stressed, negative, unhappy? It's just that might actually not be correct, but I'd say more often than not, people go on and probably just feel a bit shitter than before they went on. And
I'm happy to say that maybe it's to do with the people I follow or the people I engage with,
which is obviously very important.
I am very careful about that, but I often come on there being like, gosh, Lisella, you've lost 2 hours. In those 2 hours, what else could you have been doing? So it's more that, so if I do have a source of stress, it's mostly at myself for procrastinating. There is a correlation, even if the content I've engaged with has been positive. There is an element there that says, what more could you have been doing with your time that could have added to you being able to have your own moment to celebrate, or either on the feed or off the feed? And I think the stuff that happens off the feed is also really downplayed. And as you say, if it's so important, totally, you do make the time. You make the time to connect with people and to share them. And as you sort of, you're obviously in a business of connecting people and sharing them with them, but are they things that you've learned also to protect your time for yourself in that? Because I imagine when you're doing an event job like you are, when you're producing, you're very immersed in people. What kind of have you found ways in which that you can make time for yourself? Because I imagine that's something that is a challenge in your world.
Oh, I really, really struggle with that. And I'm one of these people that I'll get up at 6 a.m., I'll work out, I'll go for a big walk, especially in lockdown. And that's my time. But exercise for me is my time. No one's bothering me. I'll put on a podcast if I'm walking. I listen to so many podcasts, predominantly like business podcasts or ones that are kind of going, I just get something from, rather than just an entertainment podcast. And then all day, I'm just like, I tried to take Tuesday off because it was like the day after bank holiday. I was actually with my nephew and it didn't happen because like you just can't, and everyone says, just don't look at your emails. When you run your own business, you can't do that. And you are constantly thinking about your work. And like I said earlier, I get so passionate about things. So I have, like, in the morning when I'm exercising, that is when I have all my ideas. That is just when everything just happens. And then I'm like, oh my God, we can do this and we can do this. And so then the rest of the day, I'm like thinking about it and like, how can I action these things and reaching out to people? So, but this sounds probably very stressful to a lot of people, but work and life are very much merged into one. Like work is my life. And everyone always says, oh, you need a work-life balance. Well, what does that actually mean? Because I love my work and a lot of my friends are in work and I've met so many incredible, you know, like I've got so many friends that I've actually met through work. And if that means having, you know, I've just put in I'm meeting a friend next week, which is for work, but he's a friend. And we're having lunch because now we can. And but that's work, but I guess that's social as well. And there's like so it's kind of, there's just this big crossover. And you know, like you go to loads of events because you get invited to them, obviously in lovely normal world. And but again, is that work? Like I don't know if it is. Yes, it is, but it's not really. And I don't see it as having, it's not networking. It's just hanging out with great people that I, you know, I'm at the point where I'm like, well, if I don't want to go to an event, I'm not going to go. I'll go to something if I want to, you know, if there's great people there and I want to have a good time. So I am really bad at switching off. I'm one of these people. I'll sit on the sofa and then be like, okay, what can I be doing now? 10 minutes later, I'll be up. Like even if it's cleaning the fridge or something,
it's so interesting that you say that, because what it reminds you of is, you know, the famous quote from Mark Anthony, which says, if you do what you love, you'll never work a day in your life. And I think that's probably so what you are trying to express, right? That you have actually found something that you absolutely immersed in, you're absolutely passionate and driven by that. So for you, as you talked about there, that blurred line between the work-life balance actually doesn't exist, because you are completely immersed in a world, as you say, where your friends are the best connections of people that you've built business relationships are all intertwined in that. And that's probably why you took the step, right, to set them all up, because it was fueling all these different sort of, let's say, things that give you energy as a person. And it happens that you make money from them as well. And it also fits in with actually
that's important.
But it's important. But it's also about, you know, coming to such an important setting that I think probably a lot of people have had as a result of their lives being disrupted over the last year as we came to grips with COVID-19 and reliving in a different way. It made a lot more people examine about actually what are the things that are really important in life and how do I set up my work life, which is now in our homes, so that it doesn't feel like work and it doesn't feel like it's draining and taking away. And I think there's a lot to be gleaned from what you've shared here today, which is that you've been completely molded and driven by understanding what you're good at, what your skills are, and how you could then put that into a job. And then after you worked out how to put it in a job, how you could build it to be a company that could serve you and be made across the values and the behaviors that you wanted to model for yourself. So I think that is something that is really inspiring to hear as somebody who's looking for my next sort of destination. Yes. So I thank you for sharing it.
Oh, no, pleasure. And we need to remember we're in lockdown. The last year has been just so crazy and has changed people in good ways, in bad ways, whatever you want to say. But we need to remember that we will be out of this as well. This is only temporary. Yes. So don't make any rash decisions. Don't make, you know, it's just, I think everyone needs to kind of get a bit of a grip on that. And we've all adapted, but we'll have to be adapting again in the next year or so and beyond because this is the new normal. But then what's the new normal going to be in 4, 5, 6 months time to a year? So, which is really hard, because how can you keep making decisions when things are so fast turning? And so, but you just have to be really adaptable, I think.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that's such a good call. And I think when you talk about adaptability and you talk about looking ahead, I think it tees us up quite nicely sort of for our finale here, which is, I really like to always ask this question, particularly for people like you who have so much great energy and ideas and are constantly looking to for the next thing. What would you like to sort of, if you look back in 40, 50 years time, because you're young, so we do have to go that far.
I don't know about
yeah.
that.
Yeah, she is, ladies and gentlemen, do not believe her. What would you like to sort of look back on and sort of have as your legacy? What is the thing that you'd love to overhear someone say about you?
I think I've got a couple of things. One sounds really, really cheesy. I wrote it down earlier and I was like, oh my God, I don't know if I can say this. But
no, say it.
Whether it's a conversation someone's had with me, whether they've listened to a podcast, a radio show that I've produced, or they've come to an event, an underground fan club event. I just want people to leave feeling happy. And that's just something that, like, from people that have been to the events and that have come up to me afterwards, whether it is the talent or whether it's the fans, and just been like, oh my God, it's such a good time. This is amazing. Like, to hear that, we did an event with Essex a couple of weeks ago, which was a fitness event. And I got AJ, Adudu and Fleur East and Dr. Zoe, they're all good friends of mine. And we're in a WhatsApp group together. And afterwards, they were all leaving voice notes. And everyone was just on such a high. And everyone was like, oh, my God, I love doing that. And I just thought, oh, my God, I've just created an event. And everyone feels really happy at the end of it. And, you know, we're in lockdown. It's a Monday night. Everyone's just usually watches Netflix and is just a bit over it. And you know, we had over 1,000 people join in, and we had the comments that we were getting on YouTube was just like, it was amazing to see it. And that's like the moment where you go, oh my God, I did this, or obviously with a team full of amazing people. But that's the moment where you get, okay, I've brought happiness into people's lives. And that's really important to me. And then I guess the other one is I always want to do something different to everybody else. That is really, really important to me. And Underground Fan Club, I feel like we're doing something completely different. We've ripped up the rule book on what events there are in the sports world, and I guess in fitness now. And I don't know if it's going to work. I'm kind of giving it a go and I'm trying out, but I honestly believe in it and I do think it'll work. And I think it's going to be with so many exciting plans ahead. So I just want people to think, oh, Charlie, just like she's always, people always say this to me, like, God, you've got so many ideas and they're all so unique and different. And that's something that I really pride myself in. Yeah, that was a very long-winded way of saying, I just want to be unique and different and whatever I create for people to kind of recognize that.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And I think it's definitely something that you're on your way of. You already have one of two really great shows that emulate it and stand up to that. And I have no doubt that in 5-6 years time, Underground Fan Club will have completely changed how people think about experiences. And I think definitely 100% you're on your way to living your legacy of making everyone feel happier, because I think after everyone listens to this podcast and feels your passion and how animated and you love it, they'll definitely give them a lift. So I just want to say another big thank you to you for giving me your time.
Thank you.
Yeah,
it's been so much fun. Love talking to you, and we'll definitely get a wine in soon in person.
100% I will hold you to that. I look forward to coming to an Underground Fan Club event, of course.
Yes,
as well.
Hopefully this summer. So watch out,
definitely. Yeah, I will be. I will fake my ticket if I don't get one from you as well, just so you know.
Hey, you'll be on the guest list. Not that we even have a guest list. Everyone's invited.
Love it. Well, thank you very much to everyone for listening in to another episode of In Her Corner. I've been with the absolutely vivacious Charlie Copsey.